volatile financial markets, others benefit from them. And this is a consensus in the literature in general that there was these kind of two well-defined segments within the middle class, those who impoverished during the 90s and those, the so-called winners. So there is, again, this argument about the heterogeneity within the middle class. And this heterogeneity pattern also show up in the housing options that the middle class had during the 90s, and there was new housing options coming out. On the one hand, there was an expansion of the housing credits that they were not before, they were not available for the middle class before. So there is one expansion of the private credits for the middle class. Second, there was also an expansion of public subsidies for housing, but still only for those low-income middle households in Mexico. And third, there was an expansion of this high-end sector that was related more to this project like gated communities in Mexico City. So in general, what we can see is a diversification of the housing option for the middle class in the city. So based on that, or in more general, we can ask if in a context of increasing inequality, if in this context, resident segregation increases. And also we can ask more clearly how did the middle class contribute to such trend? For example, did the average neighborhood they live in change? Did this spatial distribution alter during this decade? And if so, how this translate into segregation indices? Also, we can ask, is it possible to identify different residential patterns between middle-class groups, or it's a single pattern what dominates? Of course, we can all wonder why does it matter, in particular, the middle class. I mean, we all are familiar about the theories about the impacts of residential segregation on life chances, but why, in particular, we should care about the parts of the middle class? So I think I'm not going to go to the theories about resident segregation of land chances, but I just want to point to the fact that this study suggests that when economic restructuring takes place, it will harm communities in two ways. It could impact directly income levels of the residents and therefore increase the segregation of the poor, I mean towards social mobility, but it could also have future effects in its composition, ones that better off families leave neighborhoods that are rapidly deteriorating. So it's basically the thesis that the fly of the middle class from these neighborhoods. And these studies also claim that the presence of the middle class families is central to maintain economic, political, and social resources in the neighborhoods. In addition to this, I wonder about the political implication of the greater segregation of the middle class in countries like Mexico. And this speaks to the possibilities of building social consensus across income groups to support, for example, investment on urban infrastructure or universal social programs. More precisely, I wonder what will happen to cross-class coalition in a city like Mexico. If we believe this hypothesis that a lot of what was what made possible the Mexican political regime was this cross-class coalition, but mainly if we think that this cross-class coalition was based in kind of the micro politics at the neighborhood level, it was not only a construction at the party level and at the macro level, but it's actually based to some extent in this macro politics occurring within the neighborhoods. So, I wonder about this because in part, if we think about how political parties are organized in Mexico, they are territorially based, right? So a lot of the previous ruling party and the current ruling party in Mexico City, the PRD, is actually organized based on neighborhoods organization. And so if the composition of the neighborhoods is changing, that could also alter the cross coalition in general, I mean, at the global level. So it's kind of these micro, micro links. Okay, I have 5 minutes, so I guess I'm just gonna run through this. So I will say I'm using a definition of I'm using per capita income to define middle class, and this is just a data limitation. I just don't believe that I can define middle class solely based on income, but that's the data that is available at the AHEP level, which is very similar to census tract. So, but it's the type of data that is public available for the, well, it's not public available. I have a special form from the Census Bureau. But this is the type of data that I are willing to give you. And so that's the information that I could have. And I have the number of households that fell into each of the income deciles. So when what I did was to divide my socioeconomic groups into three categories. I defined the low income a group as household in the bottom 15%, the 15 percentile, the middle group between the 50 and the 19 percentile, either high income group in the top, in the 10%. So as you can see, the middle category, it's quite broad. So, and the idea was to capture this group that was kind of the lower middle income category. And if I'm just not going to spend that much time there, if I only have five minutes, but I just want to say two things there. One is the idea to capture the diversity of the middle class. The second is this type of definition allows comparison across time between 90 and 2000, which is what I'm going to do. And the second thing is that maybe the, if I look at how these three categories correlates with other socioeconomic indicators like profession, for example, the percentage of manager and professional workers in each of these categories, then the 50 per, the decile, the sixth decile, it's the one when you can see a threshold, right? So that, the, for example, the percentage of professional workers in this percentile shift rapidly after that. So I think that to some extent you still capture a little bit of the of that shifting in that percentile in particular. And the other thing that I want to say is that the high category is quite diverse within. So the maybe some of what you are, some of you are using as a reference for the middle ha- the middle class is actually within this category, like the upper middle class, I would say. So just to give you an idea, this is the distribution on the high, the middle class percentage. Yeah, this is the middle class. Oh, something happened with my slide. No, here it is. Yeah. This is the distribution of the middle class. I'm just going to go very quickly to them. I don't know. Just I want to show you that they are very clustered, that the high percentage neighborhoods of the middle class in Mexico City, in the center, and the west part a little bit, the center, the west part a little bit, and north part of the city, and it changed, it expanded actually to the contrary, what we think, to the east part and to the north, and that's mainly because of the expansion of the public subsidized housing in some of these areas, and so that's one of the reasons, and the other reason could be also because of some of the gains that some of these are well-established working-class neighborhoods, actually. And so some of these, the other type of surveys have shown that these groups gain during the second part of the 90s so in their percentage of income. So that's something that maybe is being captured in this. And this is the other map, just the percentage of high income population in the city. And as you can see, it's very, very clustered. It's actually very dramatically clustered in this area. For those of you who know, this is Las Lomas, Chapultepec, Santa Fe, and all that area. I don't know if you have been there, but all some people are nodding, so they know what I'm talking about. And then it's even more clustered, so in the 2000 in the 2000 census. So, and I'm gonna jump to the indexes of segregation. So as you can see, actually the levels of racial segregation across the income strata are relatively low compared to other societies. And this is in general, I think, when you disaggregate the indexes, is actually the contribution of the middle class groups in some of these areas. The middle class defined as I'm defining them, I mean, in a very broad sense. And this is, if you can see, while the high income groups are far more segregated, the low income, the middle income groups have very reduced levels of segregation. And then you can see that the segregation between the middle and the high income groups actually increased quite significantly during the 90s. And while the segregation between the middle and the lower income groups did not. So during even if increased, it only increased marginally during that time. And then I'm going to distinguish between within the middle class group. And so if you look at that, you will see that actually the low middle category, I mean, and I define those between the above the median and the 70 percentile, group actually desegregate from the lower income household during that period. And but it became quite segregated from the high income, of course. I mean, they are very related. And then what I call the solid middle household, which are the next group, then
to the
90, yeah, the 70 to the 90, then that group actually did increase their segregation from the lower income household. So that you can see that there is actually a divergent pattern between the middle class group. So they don't follow the same residence segregation pattern. And these are indexes that consider not only the levels or the degree of the diversity within each of the neighborhoods, but the overall spatial distribution in the city. And this maybe made more sense if I just show the maps of these indexes. And what these ellipses show is the overall distribution of each of these groups in the city. So they actually map how wide or how concentrated, for example, how concentrated the distribution of this group are in the city. And I'm just going to go very quickly over them. So if you compare, quickly, like this. So what you can see is that the high-income group, the red ellipse circle, became far more segregated in spatial terms. It's more narrow. It's concentrated to the west of the city.
Sure.
There is. And while the middle class household actually expanded a little bit, and that's the effect of the lower middle class households. And also, and it's the same for the low income households. But in general, what I wanted to show with these spatial indexes is the idea that what changes during this time is not only the level of diversity with each neighborhood, but in general, where this group located in the city. So what happened is not only that the diversity within neighborhoods changed, but where they are located, and so that the city became more segregated by region, so that certain regions of the city are far more homogeneous than they were before. So in the 90s, certain areas were more heterogeneous if you consider that one neighborhood, for example, a poor neighborhood will be surrounded by neighborhoods who has a different social composition. But now what you can see, it's a far more homogeneous composition of a region, not only a neighborhood. So that's the idea of the spatial segregation index. And so what these spatial indices are showing is that type of concentration in the city. So I'm going to finish because I'm well over my time. And so in general, what I'm trying to describe here, and I didn't went to some of the details of these changes, but was this idea that there was an intense, a growing segregation of the upper strata. And if you consider that, depending on what definition you are using, if that is your definition of the upper middle class, for example, and that could be, then the middle class is really impacting levels of resilience segregation, because all the indexes show that that's really what is changing in the city. But if you're using my definition of middle class, which is a more narrow definition of the middle class in the sense of the percentiles that you are looking at, then there is a small increments of the impacts of, of the middle class in racial segregation in during that period. However, the spatial indicators suggest a more pronounced phenomenon, so that even if the middle class only impact to some extent the segregation indexes, they still have an important effect in terms of homogenizing certain regions by income strata. And there is also an important difference between the lower middle class and what I call the solid middle class, in terms that they differ in how they impact the levels of resilience segregation and also where they live. And I didn't show that map, but there is also a pattern that they diverge in where they do locate in the city. And then, of course, I think that we have to really think carefully about what is the implication of this pattern, if any, and then to consider what does it mean, this diverging pattern between a middle class group, and to what extent is useful or not to use this category based on income.
Okay, so we have a lot to think about. We have 40 minutes, so I thought we'd take our round of questions and then allow each of our speakers to respond.
It's very interesting. I love the way of wanting to think about bourgeois classes in the context of economic development, and we also have a very tight micro perspective as well as a much more macro perspective here. And given our focus, I'm going to throw out a proposition, a comparative proposition.
Number six.
And briefly explain the logic of it and ask both the speakers to comment on it. Is it possible that the political role of middle classes in Asia, East Asia, growing Asia, let's call it, not only East or South, high growth Asia, is likely to be a lot more assertive and versus the role of political role of middle classes in Latin America is likely to be more defensive? Let me explain why I think this might be so. I'm not sure if anybody is, but there's evidence for it. Sporadic, I'm not sure if it's generalizable. It really caught my eye when, in your paper, you suggested that inequality decreased in the time of recession, in the bad 80s, and then increased. Now, I know that that is also true for Brazil, where I looked at the data closely. And one of the things that's coming out now, based on a variety of econometric studies, is that the decline of inequality we are seeing in some of Latin America, especially Mexico, Brazil, and possibly a couple of other countries, has a lot more to do with the rich losing more in the recession than the poor. Sort of as distinct from the idea that new left has come into power and they are the ones who have brought the inequality down. So it's not Lula, it's how the bad 1980s unrolled. I don't like that conclusion, but that is what's beginning to come out of evidence. All right. Now supposing that's true, right, that itself is controversial, supposing that's true, nothing like that happened. In Asia, from 1980 onwards, especially the giants, China and India, but also South Korea, except for a short period of financial crisis, which in most countries didn't last more than 3-4 years, maybe Indonesia lasted longer. Growth has been much more steady, upwards, and you get a sort of a growing sense of a broadening middle class. So I wonder, you know, middle classes are pretty fickle politically, and all this can change, but I wonder if economic insecurity in Latin America is creating more defensiveness, and You see that even in the residential patterns, the way they came out on the maps, sort of almost like, you know, sort of throwing up a fort around you. So you see some of that even in India, so I don't want to make too much of that. But on the whole, there is a sort of a defensive spirit to it, where in Asia, you get a much more of a spirit of aggressiveness, assertiveness. And so I'm wondering if one, how far we can generalize that these are two very different middle class patterns of development based on the economic patterns.
Okay.
Actually, I have a related question, but almost the opposite, because I wanted to ask the historical version of it, which is, I was struck when Diane said, you know, she had to include small businesses in her definition of middle class. And Devesh and I, this morning, were talking about how in colonial countries, professions played a specific role because it was a route for upward mobility in a professional setting. If you want to be part of the modernizing, you had to have education, you had to be a professional, and you could get hired in the upper echelons of the public sector. And that might be really different in Latin America, where the colonial period really ended 100 years earlier. Mm-hmm. And so I wondered if you want to think a little bit about that. And that actually led me to a second question that really is to both of you, which is whether you see the growing segregation, particularly these gated communities, which I think is a huge phenomenon in these global cities. I mean, I've seen it in so many cities now. Whether it's whether we should be thinking about this as a thing that will change middle class political roles and political support for public services globally, or whether it's a reflection of the decline in public services and the privatization of public services, and somehow, in both of your presentations, you were talking about in terms of what it meant for future coalitions, but maybe it reflects previous policies and you didn't think about that.
Yes, and then the next.
First, just a quick point that I think the question of the relationship between the middle class and inequality is really dependent on how we define the middle class, because obviously if we define the middle class in terms of what deciles you are, on the income scale, the relationship between that and inequality is going to be very different from whether we define middle class terms of income levels, in which case actually growing inequality goes along with the growing middle class, or often goes along with the growing middle class. But the question I want to ask, and this is based on my historical sense of Latin America, is that, and I wonder, what if pathways in the contemporary context is there a middle class outside the capital city? I'm not sure, you know, from what I know about 19th century Peru, I'm not sure that either internally or externally defined, there's a group that we can think of as a middle class that has any sort of group identity that's not in.
The expansion of the lower middle class, was that because the low income groups moved up or because upper income groups moved down? So if you could give us a sense of some mobility that is occurring, which way is it? Just sort of things up aloud. The middle class, at least if I think about India, you know, or in fact in most of the developing countries, if you like in Latin America, was associated with state-owned enterprise and state with employment, especially salaried income. That was the basis of building a sort of middle class. What's happened in the past 25 years, that part of the economy has shrunk in most places, and the growth of where it is occurring is more in the private sector. Now, interestingly, the nature of labor contracts in the private sector, even in white collar professions, is no longer the old fixed salary income. And that part, I'm just wondering how you see that sort of changing sort of notions of how nature of labor contracts itself is changing, even in sort of old white collar jobs. The other sort of observation is that is about middle class political activism. It's occurring, I mean, we just had elections in India, and one of the things you see is, which is very odd, you know, India is an outlier, in that middle class participation rates in elections is actually lower than the lower classes. But in India, it's the opposite. Or at least, it's no less than. And the thing we are seeing is that middle class is politically active, but it is not active through political parties. It's active through so-called NGOs. You know, it files public interest litigations, it organizes all sorts of ways. But I'm not quite sure why it is not taking the root. Whereas, if you take the old route, which is the creation of the Congress Party, the Congress Party was created by professionals. They were all lawyers, etc. So in earlier times, they participated in parties. Now, as maybe because of the expansion of the franchise, because lower class groups are now more politically active, they seem to have shifted the locus of political activism outside traditional political parties to other mechanisms. And I'm wondering if you observe that also in your work in America.
And then other hand?
Thanks. I'm going to argue actually the opposite point to Matthews, but later on, so I don't say too soon. But the question, I have a question to Diane about regional effects. Could you, when you look at sort of, you know, cross-national, do you think that the role of regional effects is stronger in your cases coming from different parts of the world than the role of some sort of general regularities of development and modernization? Right? So do you think that Asia has, or parts of Asia, those peculiarities which can be really attributed to sort of historical legacies and peculiar cultural formations and so on. And if this is the case, do you see this over time declining or increasing? And also, what would be the main things which come to mind? Is it something about the role of the state? Is it something? Is the case that the welfare state is much smaller in Asia, or at least in some parts I know, than it is in Latin America, for example, or Eastern Europe? Right. So that's the question to Diane, and the question to Andy is about I'm fascinated by first of all, congratulations on this sort of classical Chicago School paper, which is absolutely wonderful. So great that sociologists are going back to this kind of research. I'm fascinated by the sort of certain deterritorialization of the middle class, and Devesh mentioned that already. I wonder whether you see that in sort of looking closely on the ground, that sort of mobility of capital and mobility of labor across national borders is creating something different on the ground in places like Mexico City. So, the point I'd like to make later on will be that this territorialization of the middle class is causing depoliticization. But I wonder whether you can see other effects in terms of welfare and income and the way in which the income is invested in the community.
Okay, we're going to take one more question. We'll give the speakers a chance to respond. Then we'll take a second round of questions. And I have Deborah, and I have you, and a gentleman. So, Raka, and then.
Hey, one of the things that I think Landy's paper makes very clear is that, of course, we have this class fraction problem with the middle class. And I've always been interested in what the middle class means, and I'm increasingly convinced that really the importance of the middle class is sort of cultural and ideological. So let me just illustrate what I mean, and then sort of throw it open to both of you. In the 60s and 70s, in India, you had sort of two dominant representations of the middle class. One is when you have the then Prime Minister Nehru himself saying, "I'm just a middle class man." You know, anything you know about Nehru's history would make it surprising that he would say this. But he meant it. He wasn't being disingenuous. He saw himself as that fraction of the middle class that was going to lead India to the new modern democratic India. But at the same time, in the 70s, you have the cartoon representation of the middle class, which is the R.K. Lakshman cartoon of the common man, who is this kind of elderly, fuddy-duddy guy with tufted hair, an umbrella, perpetually bemused expression. He's clearly a political servant of, a public servant of some kind, but he's on the outside. And he's looking in at the shenanigans of the politicians, and he experiences the effects of corruption and price rise, and he's helpless, right? So those were the two representations. Today, and I think this is illustrated by this bifurcation in some sense that you were talking about, I would say that in India there is one representation, the upper end representation, which is far more hegemonic. The sort of chattering classes that Atul was referring to has become much more the dominant characterization and cultural representation of the middle classes without this other side. And I'm wondering if there are parallels in from your work.
Well, I think we'll reverse the order. So, Landy, if you could keep your comments to 5-6 minutes so we can have another round of questions, that'd be great.
I think I'm going to start by Gates' question about the gated communities, if I remember that was the other question. I think was mainly for Diane. I think that... Yes, I think that to some extent the gated communities is an answer to what has been the deterioration of the urban infrastructure in the city, and also in general the fear to crime, and that it is growing in Mexico City. I mean, it's not an on-base response to that situation, but it's kind of feedback, right? I mean, the gate communities at the same time deteriorate even further the possibilities to actually, for example, promote the investment in urban infrastructure, because then there is not enough funding for doing that, but it's also there is no consensus to invest in this type of projects, because one part of the city, of the population in the city, is solving these problems by their own means, and so there is not enough support among certain communities in certain regions of the city about this. So I think there is no clear answer about that. Well, something that I just want to mention that surprised me is when I was doing some of the interviews in some of the neighborhoods, there was a gated community nearby, and I always have this really terrible image about how bad gated communities were. And I didn't expect some of the answer from some of the residents in this more poor neighborhoods nearby. And what they told me was more like they kind of benefit indirectly from some of these communities, in the sense that the state, the local state, provides some urban infrastructure for those communities. I mean, they provide regular water supplies, regular electricity, regular, right? And so the neighborhoods who were nearby benefit from those type of services. So it was a kind of subordinate benefit from these communities. And it doesn't mean that this is the best pattern to follow, but I mean, it's just that it's not so easy to see the relationship between gated communities and urban development in general. The other thing that someone mentioned is that, yes, I think that the relationship between the middle class and inequality depends how you measure the middle class. And some of the statistics that I, and I always hesitated to give this general statistic about if the middle class grow, it shrink, or what happened to that, because it always depends exactly how you're measuring the middle class. And so even the pattern about if inequality increases or not during a certain period, it also depends on how you are calculating the share of the income and all these kind of things. So, and in this case, for example, I think in the Mexican case, this is very clear. During the 90s, for example, at least everybody has suggested that the inequality decreases after the 95 crisis, because the upper stratum decreased their shares in the total income in the country. So was the argument that it was made before. It's not because the people at the bottom of the income distribution improved, but it's just because the others lost a part of the share. So none of the redistributional policies set in place actually work. That was actually the argument. But this also depends how you define the category. So that's one point. And the other is there a middle class outside the capital city? I think that there is. And it's increasing in the last year, precisely because Mexico City is losing the urban primacy they used to have. And so it is very clear. And there are other industrial cities that are coming out more prominently in the last decade. So I think what is interesting to see, for example, is that this middle class has a different profile in other urban areas, and that, for example, in my type of research that I do, in residential segregation is even more pronounced in some other industrial cities, like Monterrey, for example, has a higher level of residential segregation than Mexico City does, and it has to do with the way that the middle class and the upper class were constructed, that are far more defined, and there is also more land regulation in this city than it was in Mexico City. Like informal settlements in Mexico City really help a kind of social mixing in the city. I think I went over 5 minutes. And then someone asking about the deterioration. Again, it depends on what definition of the middle class you are using, because I think that when I was doing interviews, there is no deterioration at all, but I'm looking at middle class who really is this middle class who are just middle, barely middle, you know? So for them, there is not this upper middle class life. They are not moving away, they are not traveling, they are living in the neighborhood, so making a living, and there are professional people. I mean, I was interviewing a professor at the university who work at the national universities and who has a PhD degree, but they still have a very grounded life in the city, and their practices and their life are pretty much very territorialized, and their everyday life happen within the frontiers of neighborhoods and expectation. But I do think what Rocca was suggesting, that what he has changed, at least in the imaginary of these people, is not necessarily the practices, but how they perceive themselves. So what I notice in my interviews is that even if their practices haven't changed that much, the way that they perceive themselves is in kind of in a downward mobility position, in the sense that they are comparing to these other standards, right? So that even if they're in absolute terms, their income haven't changed, and their practices, I mean, in their average income haven't changed, or their social position in kind of structural terms haven't changed much in the last years, they do perceive themselves as experiencing downward mobility, in the sense that they comparing themselves to this middle class who has access to all these goods and all this, this kind of life that is supposed to be the life that the upper middle class, and they are not having access to that.
5 minutes.
I'll start backwards with the last question, because Atul's is the hardest one, and I'm not sure I can get to that, so if I start backwards, it won't make sense. but there's some kind of logic. I mean, Rocca, I think that I really like very much and we'll hear about that later, the focus on the meaning of the middle class, not what they are and what they're doing, but, you know, what does it mean to think about the middle class, and how do middle classes think about themselves and cultural and ideological underpinnings? And I don't really have a great answer to your question, but what you made me think about, and I get, actually all the questions are great for everybody to kind of project on. I'm just taking the moment to think on my feet out loud. But this, I think that what you're suggesting is that we need to study a little more representations of the middle class. And what I would say, and I don't work in that world, but I would say what I know about it, that they're shifting. And that's what we need to look at, the shifting kind of iconicity, but what is the representative, you know, iconic middle class in these places and whether it's similar or different. What, just thinking about India and Mexico and the cultural representation, I mean, you mentioned Nehru, but I'm thinking in a more contemporary way about, if we think about film, Ray, I know Bengal better, so if we think about, and this is an answer Gregor's about regional, but sub-regional, not regional, there are certain regions and places in India where the middle class has a iconic identity, and in Bengal it does. Part of that is the history of colonialism, et cetera. But the more contemporary version, I'm thinking about iconic representations of class. I think about Slumdog Millionaire. In my category, some of those people that live in those slums would fall into the small producer middle class. So how this gets, and, but the fact that this is a somebody that makes it in terms of income, this is a new representation that might be, that comes in a global context. So I think it's a great question, and I'd like to see how it shifts. In the case of Mexico, what I think the problem, they, in Mexico, maybe you can know better about this, is there has never been a legitimate representation of the middle class in some kind of iconic sense because of the history of the revolution, the structure of politics. Even as I mentioned, that organization of the party is called the Popular Organizations, Popular Middle Class. Nobody would dare identify themselves as a middle class. So even being able to have an iconic representation of the middle class in the contemporary is something to look at. How did and why does that happen? That gets to Gregor's question about a universal process, modernization. What I would have said, but this is a better example, there are sub-regional ways this happens, even in the same country over time. But the larger question is about maybe my epistemology. I can't think about universal modernization processes. I just can't. Some people have. I would say the best I can get to is path dependency. And one thing I would say is that in the book that I wrote on East Asia and Latin America, in my the final chapter, I compare the successful models to England and the United States. I think I got in a lot of trouble because I'm jumping paradigms and historical periods to say that there were similar processes and similar actors explaining developmental success in East Asia as we saw in the United States and England, but not in France. So it's not a West, North-South thing, but I would still suggest you can have the same actors relevant over time, but the outcome will be different. And this is the other point I would make that I think we'll probably talk about for the next day and a half, is even if we're all interested in the middle class, the point is it's class relationships. Who is a middle class create alliances with within themselves and other classes and the state? And I think that determines the outcome. So even if we could say it's the same actors and they have the same iconic representation, you're going to have a different developmental outcome. And what I try to do in my talk is bring space into that too, because the developmental, we're seeing in the physical environment the consequences of class relationships in politics. That's kind of Gay's question about gaining, which I won't go into too much. What else might be more important in response? Oh, to Devesh's question, I think it's the same thing in Latin America. So this is a debate then with Atul about middle classes being more active in NGOs and non-political parties. A difference in Mexico again, well, both Mexico and Argentina have had middle class political parties that are separate, and they've been very conservative and reviled. Mexico now has a president from that middle class party who cannot keep anything together, but that's not just because of the middle class, the history of middle class ideologies and their regional concentration from the north and not in the city. That's an answer to you. Yes, they're middle class all over Mexico, and they dominated politics other places. They just haven't dominated in Mexico City. But if we think again about representation and kind of a national discussion, middle classes have been involved in party politics, but they really don't like being involved in party politics, and they are are more involved in NGOs now. But I do think there are really important differences, and India is much more active. And then maybe that gets to Atul. So when you said assertive versus defensive, I don't know if I'd use that terminology, but I think that the ways in which the fragmentation and the relationship, the ways in which middle classes are involved in politics, in civil society, the balance of their involvement in civil society versus the state is different in East, in rising Asia. Let's put China on the side and wait to hear from Deborah. I don't want to put that in there. Then Latin America. But that has to do with histories of democratization, decentralization are very different. Poverty, the extreme poverty and the global support for NGOs in poverty action has just changed the balances. And I just think that we want to find out a little more to the answer to the question that you raised. And I think I'll get the response.
Great. So we have exactly 11 minutes. How about 6 minutes for some more questions and 5 minutes for responses? So I have Deborah, I have Noah, I have this gentleman, and then this gentleman.
I find both presentations have
minimalist, non-conservative too, or something else. As opposed to what we used to say about Latin America earlier, authoritarian versus democratic. I think maybe Latin America moved away from that dichotomy and is now into the actual role of the state. And I'd like to hear about this sort of role from within, the differentiated middle class that you alluded to very, very powerfully. And finally, on the issue of cultural products, I think it's extremely important. Middle class is a producer of cultural products and the vivacious consumer of the products. And the distinction again here about the cultural products in Mexico or in Latin America. Mexican soap operas have influenced middle class identity in so many other countries, believe it or not, just like Turkish soap operas have done, just like Egyptian soap operas have done, just like Bollywood. How much of the cultural products in Mexico are actually coming back to reinforce or perpetuate certain polarizations within them?
Okay, we have two more questions, but if we could keep them very, very brief so that we can give our speakers a chance to respond. Brief and succinct, thank you. Yes?
I'll make it quick. What is the role of the middle class in the participation of the political process in Mexico? The reason I'm asking is this. I was in India recently during the parliament election, and I visited a number of urban areas, and all the newspapers said there was 74% participation, 30% voted in the political process, except the middle class, especially the new middle class, stayed away from the political process. My question is that that is a unique phenomenon in India, or is it true in other emerging societies?
Thank you. So you have 2.5 minutes.
Well, just quickly, should I start?
Sure.
So Deborah, I think you're interested. One reason that I didn't speak about wealth is, remember, I'm not talking about just the new middle classes. So already it becomes a concept that might be, I'm sure we'll hear more from you, to distinguish between the solid and the upper middle classes.
No, but I said wealth, I mean assets.
Oh, okay, assets. All right. So you're, you know, influenced by the social capital argument here and class discussion in the United States. Now, we can't just look at class, we have to look at assets. I think that it's possible that one could include assets, but because what I would prefer to use, and maybe this is a distinction we can discuss over lunch, is accumulation.
That's
and
right.
Reproduction. Because if the kinds of folks that I'm interested in terms of middle classes are these small producers, informal sector, they need to accumulate, but it is not, they don't create assets that are there forever. They need to constantly generate income, and then they constantly plow it back in. And that's really the quintessential middle class approach. It's not like then taking these assets and putting them in a bank or et cetera. So I'm not opposed to the idea. I just didn't have an opportunity to bring it in, but I think it's important to think about that to the extent that it reproduces either homogeneity or heterogeneity in the middle class. But I would also add on to this, you've opened a new line that I was going to ask Landy. There is some really interesting work in the discussion about class urban in the urban field by a guy named Peter Saunders on housing classes. He's trying to critique, I don't know if you've read his work, so he does a critique of Castells and Harvey and all those other folks and saying we can't think about urban issues by just understanding traditional class categories. There's something called the housing class, so you can have working class people own their own houses, and where does that fall into the category? That would be something along the lines of what you mean by assets, and it speaks directly to what your research is on. I don't think it changes class category, if you widen class, not just to be about income or consumption, if you think about it as a labor process, it shouldn't change it completely, but it's something to discuss. I'll let her answer the question about individuals and households, because I'm more interested in institutions and collectivities, organizations. I don't really have an answer about the cell phones or transportation, but I would say that what they do speak to is the importance of thinking about space and how people commune. Do they do face-to-face communication this is something that I want to talk to you a little about. More, having a snapshot of where people are living and not living doesn't tell me anything about how they're living. And what is the kind of everyday streetscape, and how do people think? There's a lot of gating in those areas, including in low-income areas. It's not just upper-income areas. So thinking about technology and how it changes individuals and households' relationship in space, I think is really important to understand the urban new middle classes. I don't have answers to it, but I do think it is changing those relationships.
Yeah, I think the concept of wealth could be useful in the terms of like looking at the assets that the households have. You get me thinking about this idea of housing, like how much people have assets in the housing asset in the housing asset. Well, anyway, in the sense that, but I don't know how useful will be as a discriminatory variable in the case of Mexico City in particular, because, for example, just to give you an idea, like about 76% of the population in Mexico City claims they own their own house, right? Like they just say that they own it. They have no papers, like half of them have no paper to show it, but they claim they own it. So that's one of the problems that we have. And saying, but maybe a more profound definition of wealth, like the one that I guess you are proposing, at looking at the quality of the household, the housing they have, mm-hmm. like looking at like the age of the housing. I'm just thinking in census data, right, in the back of my head. So I'm just thinking about how you can operationalize those concepts in order to measure the middle class. That could be a way to try to deal with this issue about. Yeah. Some of the census data has some of these issues about how to measure a little bit in the case of Mexico, how to get a little bit more of the census data and try to get about wealth and not only income, for example, right? And that could be an option. I mean, to try to really see how people accumulate along the life course. And this also connects with your question about individual and household. I think I'm thinking about households, but it's a little bit complicated, and I just give you an example. In the east part of Mexico City, there was this Nezahualcóyotl, anyone who has been there. This is a municipality who has founded in the 50s, 60s, and it was basically a lot of rural migration, but it was regulated establishment that was more or less regulated by the state. It was land, it's well organized settlement, more or less. And so, in this area of the Mexico City, what a lot of the people who established there was actually poor household in Jamal. But many of the household in that area have access to formal employment, low rank state employees. And so if you look at the data today, these people are actually, by any definition, in the upper distribution, income distribution. And that's because they have access for many, many years to stable jobs. And that makes a huge difference in Mexico, right? And so they have access to pension, they own their own houses, and if you look at those households, it turned out that they don't classify as middle class. If you characterize it by education, for example, those people have just barely basic education, for example. They don't have professional jobs. They don't fit any of those definitions. But for example, there's daughters or sons will fit that definition. For example, their son attend universities, public universities, and they got a degree. And many of them live in the same house that their parents do. They share